This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello, and welcome to another special Entry Index Talking Tactics podcast. I'm your host, Leroy Ma, and today we'll have another look at another influential coach who has made his mark in the game of football that we know and love. In one of the earlier podcasts where I had Lee Scott as a guest, we mentioned that maybe one of the ways to try and shut down Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool team at the moment would be to try and deploy a full court, or should I say a full pitch man-marking system. Maybe that could work against Liverpool. And one of the teams Lee mentioned actually that put that off is Athletic Bilbao, and at the time they were managed by the one and only Marcelo Bielsa. And it just so happens that I know a guy who has been writing about the man himself, so this can be none other than Jet Davis. So Jet, how's it going? We've been talking about doing this podcast for the longest time now, and admittedly we've both been busy, but I'm glad we've managed to squeeze this podcast here today. Perhaps you'd like to introduce yourself, maybe explain a bit about your credentials in the past and currently as well. Give listeners a brief rundown of who you are in the world of football today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Lee, and thanks for being so patient. I know you've had to we've connected probably several times over the last 3 months to try and get on here, but thank you for being patient and let me come on. It's something I'm not keen on doing, but a bit about myself, I guess. I've worked as a coach for a number of years. I started coaching at Oxford University, I guess as your first organized structural coaching job, where it was about the team and trying to plan training sessions around the playing style and things like that. And then from there, around that time, I got really interested in a Barcelona style of play, like the rest of the world did, I guess. So, everyone took an interest in it. And I happened to work alongside someone who was doing a PhD in Spanish training mythology, John Collins. And it just gave me some little nuggets of information, enough to grip me and want to travel to Spain and speak to Villarreal coaches, Barcelona coaches, and Espanyol coaches, different coaches that I could, anyone I could get my hands on who was working at a club that used a certain playing style, but also just any Spanish coach who'd gone through the Spanish education system to get an idea of what they were doing. Then wrote my first book off the back of that, which was eventually named Coaching the Tiki-Taka Style of Play. And then, that was more, that was just feeding what I was interested in at the time, possession, pressing. And of course, like anything you do in the last 3 years, you look back at it now and you think, I was so far behind where I could go. And, I probably wasn't in a position of authority to write a book at the time, but the book did well and it sparked a lot of interest and a lot of ideas. And thankfully that gave me a sort of platform to get involved with Raymond Verheyen and set up a coach education company in the UK, do some analysis for Magnus Persson, the Estonian national team manager who's left. He's now at a Swedish club in Sweden at Malmo. And somehow ended up in Canada, Ottawa, where I'm now the assistant first team coach under Paul Dalgish. And luckily for me, Paul's another one of these deep thinkers. He might not look it, but he's a deep thinker himself. And together we get together and we discuss things on a philosophical level quite often. and then rip up the paper and chuck it in the bin. But that's, you know, and then the most recent book I wrote, which again sparked off an interest, an obsession with being philosophical, I guess. And Marcelo Bielsa is the one guy who anyone would probably allude to if they were talking about a philosophical coach in the game. So ended up writing a book about him. And that was the last book I've written. And that's where I'm at to today. You know, I published that book and working under Paul Dalglish at Ottawa Fury FC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I'm sure a lot of people know you from Twitter, and I believe many people have already bought your book and things like that. So just maybe a brief rundown for listeners who might not be too privy of who you are, but that's a great introduction and a great list of credentials there. So once again, really excited about this podcast and really happy to have you on. So I think, yeah, without further ado, let's jump straight into the podcast today. So the man of the hour at the moment for this podcast is Marcelo Bielsa, the Argentinian manager. I'm sure some might remember him through his time at Athletic Bilbao. Some might remember him at Marseille, maybe in the past with Chile or Argentina, or I guess in the more recent times, you know, his 2-day stay at Lazio where things lasted, you know, much shorter than intended. But yeah, you've written a book about Marcelo Bielsa, which I'm sure will be covered in another podcast. But how about an introduction to Marcelo Bielsa, you know, for listeners who might not know who he is and what he accomplished in football? Maybe you'd like to give a quick rundown of Marcelo Bielsa now?
Yeah, my introduction to Bielsa was actually when I was in Spain writing the previous book. And any coach I spoke to, and I really wanted to start thinking about football theory and piecing together not just the training mythology but tactics theory and everything. Any coach I spoke to would say Marcelo Bielsa, and it would come up in conversation. And it was one of those things where the more I started researching something, the less I got interested in that, the more I got interested in Bielsa. Mm-hmm. So that was the seed. And Bielsa is a true, you know, he's the sort of guy who, you know, I've never met him and I don't know him, but there's a sort of guy who will theorize the game and say there are this many ways to do this, and he'll try and make it a very rational, brutally logical game, you know, where every area of the game has been researched and there's a number of solutions. I think he says there's 32 ways to pass, pass the football, you know, and communicate through passing the football. There are X amount of ways to do this or that. And, you know, he's the type of guy who anyone who wants to try and think about the game, he's a guy with ideas that will send you off into 100 different routes. So that's why I got interested in Bielsa. So Bielsa's, you know, throughout his career has been known for being a bit crazy. I think his nickname is El Loco, which is crazy in Spanish. So he has a certain way of doing things. So he's come from a very highly educated background where most of his family are politicians or involved in politics. He played football and retired quite young, but then took an interest in what the human body could do at its maximum. So went and studied physical education at university. Then slowly but surely worked his way into management. And I think that idea of what is the maximum potential of a human body still exists today in his playing style. It's something that, you know, pressing for large parts of the game and going at full intensive actions for large parts of the game is something that makes him different to other managers. But then there's people that have played under him who have bought so much into his ideas and have sat through hours of his video and training sessions and everything that he's obsessed with, who have now become successful managers themselves. So, you know, I think it's difficult not to be interested in Bielsa because of how interested everyone else is. But then once you start to dig into it and start to speak to people who work with him or worked under him, it does, you know, he spent his lifetime dedicating his time to researching the game, and that's all most of us are doing. So, you know, that's Bielsa in a nutshell for me, is someone who is the philosopher of the game, and that's why the book's called The Philosophy.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's a very fitting name as well. You know, he's known to be a crazy fanatic about football. You know, he doesn't just work his magic on the pitch and in the training ground. He actually, according to many reports, you know, he's known for watching so many football videos. I guess whenever it's off the pitch sort of training. I think you gave a very fitting description of Bielsa as well. You know, started off I guess he made his name in the Argentinian national team. Then at Chile, he became a lot more popular. At Bilbao, he led them to a Europa League final, and that's where many people got a lot more interested in him. Then sort of got a little bit quiet at Marseille, and then at Lazio, of course, that scandalous 2 days thing happened. So yeah, so Bielsa, in the nutshell, as you mentioned, just a crazy guy with a ton of philosophies, you know. So I think that's great. I think that's what got you hooked in the first place to I guess write about him. So yeah, I think with the introduction out of the way, you know, to know the who and the what of Marcelo Bielsa, I think that's done and dusted. Maybe now we can dive a little bit more into the whys about Bielsa. You know, why is he so popular? Why do so many people rate him so highly and things like that? So I guess from a footballing perspective, Jad, without getting into too much detail yet about the footballing technical aspects like tactics, formation, and structures, without going into so much detail about that, what makes him so popular in the footballing world today?
I think in many aspects, the same reason of why Klopp is so loved and Klopp is so highly thought of is why Bielsa is so highly thought of. Okay, Klopp is more sort of rock and roll in front of the cameras and in front of the media, but Bielsa equally has his, you know, when he's speaking to the media, which is a rarity, but when he speaks to them, he gives this honest and you know, very deeply thought out and human side to him when he's in the front of the media. And Klopp does that as well. You know, Klopp's asked about players drinking and he gives his own human answer to that that's honest. And with both of them, there's real pure ideas of how they want to see the game played, and those pure ideas they're on the field. They've been implemented to its maximum. You know, Klopp wants a counter pressing side to play forward, and Bielsa, in many similar ways as well, wants his team to penetrate and play forward and rotate and move and press for large parts of the game. And that, those are Bielsa's ideas, and they certainly happen on the field. Whether they always win or not is another thing. And I think that's why, you know, on a football level, without going too much into the tactics, that's why people are so fascinated by them, is because they have such strong ideas, and those strong ideas have been implemented at what looks like, to the outsider, the most pure form of football. And a really simple game. You know, Klopp simplified the game. Certainly when he gets in front of the cameras and has been asked questions compared to Rodgers, you know, I've got a lot of respect for Rodgers. I'm sure a lot of Liverpool fans don't now, but he gave a lot of tactical information when he's put in front of cameras, and that was sort of loading his own shotgun. Klopp has come in and made the game sound so simple. When he gets in front of a cat, it's beautiful to listen to, because you come away from that interview feeling that you are the expert, whereas Rodgers, you always came away feeling like he's the expert. And I think empowering the person to feel like they're the expert is almost a useful tool to have as a manager speaking to his players. I think that's Klopp's route, and I think that's Bielsa's route. I mean, Bielsa is obviously an expert himself, but he's always empowering players and giving players and making players know their role inside out, and making it as simple as he can for players. His training sessions are simple repetitions of actions, and you know, Klopp's messages are always simple. You know, I think it was I think the right back Klein. Forgive me if I'm wrong, but one of the fullbacks for Liverpool came out lately and said he's made the role so easy for me. You know, the role of the fullback is so simple now that I've got Klopp. And I think that's why people love these people, is because they can understand it, and they're fascinated by how they do it. You know, how have they achieved this simple game that they understand?
I think that comparison between Bielsa and Klopp, you know, both very likable guys off the pitch, you know, when you are doing press conferences and things like that, they make you feel like part of the team and things like that. I think that's a really, really good comparison that I really, really like that. So I guess in previous podcasts, you know, where we discussed about different managers over the years, we heard about Arrigo Sacchi and his 4-4-2, and then after that we talked about Johan Cruyff and his unique 3-4-3 diamond midfield and the total football philosophy. I guess in terms of Marcelo Bielsa, you know, what formation do you think he introduced that sort of allowed him to make his name and become so influential in your opinion?
Yeah, there's two formations I think he's used mostly throughout his career. Since the early 90s when he was at Newell's Old Boys, Klopp's used I think we call it like a 3-1-3-3 or a 3-3-1-3, depending on what the wing backs are. And that sounds absurd. It's not a formation you would see on your FIFA computer game or your football manager. Yeah. Maybe nowadays you would, but back in 2000 when I was playing it, it certainly wouldn't have been one of the drop down options. So it's not a traditional formation as well, but it involves three centre backs, two wing backs who expected to get up and down, a four, a six, or whatever you want to call it, the holding mid who's a bit of a playmaker. And then you might have another midfielder just ahead of him on a different line, whether that player's behind the midfield of the opposition or not, or in front. And that one ahead of him is a sort of can be a 10, can be your creative force in the team. Then you'll have two wingers and a centre forward. The wingers are often dropping inside. They might not, depends who they are. Depends if it's Bosa-Jor for Chile. It could be Sanchez for Chile, who would make more diagonal runs towards the goal in behind, whereas Bosa-Jor would get up and down the line. Mm-hmm. So it really depends on the individual. And I think that quality of having a set formation in idea, which sounds very regimental, but completely adapting it to the individuals you have, is something Klopp's always done. There are certain players who didn't get Riquelme and Klopp. Not Klopp, Riquelme and Bielsa, they had their differences at times, but the individual is the one who paints the picture of what that position looks like quite often. And I think that's how Bielsa's worked throughout his career with the 3-3-1-3 formation. The other formation he's used quite a lot is 4-2-3-1, which is as mundane as I want to make it sound, but the way he does the 4-2-3-1 is he'll have two centre backs, two full wing backs, and sometimes one of those wing backs might, and again with three as well, this could happen with the 3-3-1-3. Sometimes the wing back is expected to come inside a bit, and I know Guardiola's done that a lot now, and it's been called inverted full backs, but that's something Bielsa's done for many years. And he might do that in the back three or the back four. And then two holder mids, and at Marseille, where you often use that, it was Mbula who was slightly deeper and the other one would be slightly further ahead. So again, there's two midfielders who are on different lines, they're not both the same. And then a number 10, two wingers who might go inside and a striker. And I think again, profile of player determines what that looks like exactly. And I think a lot of Bielsa's own ideas and sort of, I'm not saying he didn't do this till this game, but I know that, legend has it that he watched the 94 Ajax team play under Van Gaal. And in that team, they had Edgar Davids and I forget the other guy's name. That's awful. But two players who would play as inverted fullbacks when they're defending or centre mids when they're attacking. And that'd be one of the De Boer brothers. I'm trying to remember who it was now, but they would play a three diamond three. Mm-hmm. And the two sides of a diamond would come out and defend in wide areas.
Yep.
And I know legend has it that game was one that Bielsa's watched over and over again, and one that he's been fully inspired with. And again, profile of player and different movements to cover certain spaces. Bielsa's is someone who lays the foundations of his formation on those things, rather than this is the formation we're going to play, and this is how this person plays in this formation. He marries the two together, the player profiles and what the formation structure looks like.
Yes, what I'm getting from what you just described there is that, Bielsa is not one to just come in and say, hey, I'm a 4-2-3-1 specialist, so we are definitely going to play 4-2-3-1 and your roles are all fixed. It seems like he's more of the manager who would, look at the players that he have and I guess look at the different skill sets and see what's good and what's bad from an individual and from a group and a collection of players, and then sort of tweak his formation from there. In his Chile squad, we saw someone like Gary Medel, known for being a defensive midfielder, play at centre back, and then we see the same thing again, with Javi Martinez when he was at Bilbao. I think you are sort of echoing the, I guess the consensus, that he's more of a, let me look at the players I have and see how they fit in different areas. Do you think that holds true?
Yeah, I think that there is an element of I'm taking this formation with me from club to club. That mm-hmm. certainly exists. But like, you're right in thinking, how that, let's say his preference is, it sounds like his preference is to play 3-3-1-3 based on people I've spoken to.
Yep.
But sometimes that's not achievable. And that, that formation was one that was a response to people playing two strikers. So yep. Finding the spare man at the back and having one of those spare men step out. And that's why Medel, Martina, and a number of players throughout the career have been moved from a holder mid or a centre mid role to a centre back role, because that back three is purely about finding the spare one, having him drive into midfield and becoming a holder mid from whichever position he is, whether he's a wide centre back or a centre back. you know, and it's often the wide centre backs he wants to build. So the centre back for Chile was sometimes a pure limited centre back rather than a ball playing one. And on the right, he had Medel, and Medel would often step in with the ball and look to dictate from that position. And again, I think, you know, the fact that it worked so well at Chile was because they had a small team apart from the centre back. Mm-hmm. They had a relatively small team. And as a result, they pressed a lot higher up the field to make sure they weren't defending in and around the edge of their own box, you know, challenging for headers, which they're not going to win at. So it worked so well at Chile because it was a perfect marriage of Bielsa's ideas and the players they had. And, you know, working with the national teams is often where you see him adapt his formations a bit more because you're not able to sign a player. And he actually hasn't. You think about his career, he's not really been in a situation to sign players. You know, Bilbao, they're limited to Basque players. Mm-hmm. Chile and the other national teams are limited to your national team. Marseille, he looked like he didn't have much control over the transfer situation. And Lazio, he went there and was promised, he gave him a shortlist and said, well, we will seek these players for you. And Bielsa did his own research and found out they hadn't contacted any of the players on the shortlist. So, you know, at no point really have we seen him be able to sign players to fit his perfect vision. He's always had to adapt his perfect vision to the players. So I think that's why we see what we see with the formation and player profiles.
Yeah, I guess I really like how you explained that back three, you know, and I guess the ultimate underlying objective of having that 3-3-1-3. So, you know, I think you mentioned that back three was sort of to counteract with, I guess, other teams who play with two up top and things like that. How about in midfield? You know, there are three midfielders and then the one sort of attacking creative midfielder, and then after that three forwards. Do you think there's any other any specific reason for deploying that 3-1-3 up top?
I think, and again, this might sound really simple and too simplified, but I think the idea is to press high up the field and maximise the human capacity to move on a field. And you know, that's right back from his study days of studying the physical capacity of what a human can do. And I think that having 3-1-3-3 or 3-3-1-3 allows you to press in higher areas and numbers. And obviously it's not as simple as staying in that structure and just running towards a ball. Maybe on the left, and then the left side attacker does this, and the right side attacker comes around and gives balance. And there's a set of structures there. You know, and I'd imagine he spends a lot of time doing unopposed. Well, no, he spends a lot of time doing unopposed pressing patterns. You know, where the player runs when they do this, and then reading the next pass back to the goalkeeper or back to the centre back. You know, there's a lot of that done on the training field. But I think, you know, if we're going to keep it simple, I think it's that formation allows you to be in the best starting positions to set up a high pressing structure for him. You know, and that's not necessarily true. Maybe you can still achieve something good in a 4-3-3, and it's, you know, you push a fullback on high up the field and you get numbers in that way. But that's you know, from the simple level in terms of being in the best starting positions to move in the ways that Bielsa wants to move. That's why I think he keeps referring back to that. But the differences between 4-2-3-1 and 3-3-1-3, they might sound very different, but if you've got, and it's difficult to talk about this on a podcast because often it's images we would use for this, but if you've got, let's say you've got a fullback that comes inside on the weak side, on the side without the ball, mm-hmm. when you've got the ball, that might be your, you know, and if you were to freeze that and say, what does that look like? That might look like a holding mid. Let's say you've got a 4-2-3-1, you've got two holding mids, a back four, one fullback gets on, so now you're left with a back three, and yep. one fullback's got on. The winger on that side with the fullback's gone has gone inside. The winger on the other side stayed wide. If you were to freeze frame that image right there and what that looks like in possession, that's very similar to a 3-3-1-3 with the weak side wing back come inside. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's some similarities between the two formations. Like I said, I think it's more about the starting position for whatever processes that are going through, whether that's pressing, whether that's building out from the back, whether that's attacking in the final third. I think it's about just having that starting point and then moving from there. And I think that's how Bielsa views those formations, rather than this is the formation, this is how it works. It's more about scenarios. The centre-back's on the ball on the left-hand side of the field. How do we overload? And how do we get 1v1 on the weak side, on the other side of the field? And is that right to do on our right side or left side based on the players we've had? You know, is that player Sanchez or is it Bosa Jor? And it makes a difference.
the way you explained the formations were pretty spot on. You know, I mean, we see, for example, you know, the Liverpool under Brendan Rodgers, we can sort of predict the attacking structure. You know, we have three at the back with two centre-backs and Steven Gerrard dropping to become that deep-lying playmaker. And then typically we see Jordan Henderson and Coutinho just slightly higher up, and then, you know, Sterling, Suarez and Sturridge being the trio up top, and the two fullbacks pushing up. We can sort of dictate and predict what's going to happen. But, you know, now with Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool, it's pretty difficult to determine, you know, to even look at that midfield, even though we have three midfielders in, you know, Jordan Henderson, Emre Can, Wijnaldum and or Adam Lallana. We know that there are three midfielders there, but we are not sure if it's a double pivot or if it's a 1-2 midfield or is it a three at the back with four in midfield. We are not too sure on the formation. So I think that sort of resembles what Bielsa has with the 4-2-3-1 and the 3-3-1-3 sort of formations there. So yeah, I guess, you know, moving away a bit from the formations, do you think there are any standout traits in terms of what type of football that Bielsa wants to achieve through these different formations and I guess his coaching and training methods?
Yeah, I think and tying together the previous bit, how you deliver the message, whether it's to a group of players, whether it's to an individual. So it might be you speak to an individual and say, right, these are your 11 different options, and or what, I mean, 11's absurd. These are your three or four options. You can be here, here, or here, and it might be, depending on where this player is, you can be here, and that's an individual message to a player. Mm-hmm. Or you can do it in front of the whole team and say, right, this is one way the whole team's going to look, this is one way the whole team's going to look in a different scenario. And I think Bielsa, because of the number of individual training sessions he gives, where he might just have three midfielders out and half the team's not there, he is more the type, he has a bigger picture in mind. Maybe he has 11 different ways to build up in the back in his mind, maybe. Just a number I picked up there. But those 11 ways aren't told to all 11 players. Those six ways are told to a centre-back and five ways are told to a full-back. And these are your variabilities. You can be here or here. And there is some structure. Like it might be we must always have one holder mid in front of the opposition midfield line, but it doesn't have to be one. It can be two. And if we change to two, then you're going to be positioned like this. And it's much easier to do that sort of thing with the individual coaching stuff. So, you know, Klopp's got Pep and Linders, who does a lot of individual work, and I know he works with youth players as well. And I know that there's a lot more individual stuff going on, individual messages, individual training ideas happening now than maybe there were, you know, 5 years ago, 4 years ago at the club. And I think that, you know, we talk about training methodologies. You know, a lot of people make the mistake of being master tacticians and telling a whole team in front of the whole dressing board and the whole team watching the video. And sometimes it's only relevant for two or three players to know. And if it is only relevant for two or three players to know, then you could become more flexible by giving 100 messages to 11 rather than two messages to 11 individuals, doing two messages to the whole team. Mm-hmm. I think Mark Sampson, who's England women's manager, he does this thing where he gives everyone an individual goal tree, and an individual goal tree is a piece of paper, and it will say my attacking objective of today's game is to do X and Y, my defence's objective of today's game is to do X and Y. Maybe it's three things, three attack and three defending, and the striker will meet up with the other striker and they'll say, right, these are my attacking objective, what are yours? Okay, how can I help you achieve yours? How can you help me achieve mine? Then the strikers will then meet with the wingers, and the strikers will then meet with the centre mids, and everyone's meeting to draw together cooperation. So you've got like individual and partner cooperation, and then it comes groups, and then it's units. And then eventually that builds together to this ginormous team strategy that is relatively simple at a minute level. But when it all comes together, there's so many different movements to achieve that. You know, it might be that your striker, to keep it really simple, one striker might be you've got to get in behind the opposition defensive line as often as you can, you know, with the ball. And the other strikers might be you try and receive between and play through lines, and they just happen to be, you know, they happen to be conducive to one another. They happen to help each other out. That might not always be the case. But in that scenario, those two strikers, is very simple. Well, when you drop in the pocket and receive it, I'm going to make a run in behind. So now that striker who's dropped in already knows what's behind him because their communication's improved. They know their non-verbal communication. He knows he's going to be here based on the fact that he's done this. And then that's very, it's much easier to do it at an individual level than it is to do it at team level. And I think that's where Klopp gets a lot more variability. where Bielsa gets a lot more variability and where perhaps Rodgers didn't get as much variability because it was a team message. I think that's where tactics and training methods, you know, at one level come together and make a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like, you know, Bielsa has, I guess, the big picture in mind, but to achieve that big picture, you know, he has to break it down and then go down to the lowest level, and that is the individual players, you know, get them knowing what they need to do and what they need to do in correlation with, let's say, you know, like you mentioned earlier, with the two strikers, they need to know what each other are doing and things like that. So, yeah, I think that's a really, really interesting insight into, you know, the different coaching methods and things like that. But I think, you know, ultimately, there has to be an underlying objective, you know, for Bielsa and I guess for all football teams in general. But I know for Bielsa, I know in terms of attacking wise, what do you think are the, I guess, the standout attributes for Bielsa team? You know, what are they trying to I guess achieve, and what is their underlying objective when they are trying to attack with the ball?
Yeah, I think obviously scoring goals. I mean, that's not me being an idiot by saying that, but scoring goals is the number one thing, and then you work your way back from that, right? So if you scoring goals is the best thing, and then after that it's assisting goals, and then after that it's playing the pass that assists the goal, so assisting the assist. And then after that you're looking at ways to either get in behind the opposition back line or play between the opposition line, so between the opposition defensive midfield and defensive line and behind the opposition defence. And I think that those things are set on sort of a stone of hierarchy. And there's reasons why you won't be able to play between lines, right? You might not be able to play between lines because the opposition don't give any space to play passes through. They're too compact and there's no gaps to play through. It might be that there's no space between the lines because they're too compact and the space between lines isn't big enough to be able to move in amongst it and try and get it amongst it. And maybe they're quicker than you at the back, so you playing the ball over the top doesn't allow you to get on the end of that. Or it might be that they've got like, they might have a midfield line of three and then two behind them, so 4-2-3-1. Mm-hmm. And those two players are protecting the centre-backs, so you ideally want to pull one of those centre-backs out of position to try and exploit the space, but you can't because they've got two holding. So they might have layers, I call it. So layers in midfield. So those are three reasons why you wouldn't be able to penetrate. And I think, you know, Bielsa's looking at it and going, right, we need to be able to penetrate and do these things we put on this platform. We can't do it because of these reasons. Okay, these are the coaching methods that now, you know, how do we create more of these scenarios to be able to penetrate? How do we overload so we get in behind their centre-back? You know, and if we can't overload to get in behind the centre-back, then overloading then, what does it do? Well, it drags the opposition across the field. So who are we leaving in our 1v1 on the blind, on the weak side? And I think, thinking about how you think about attacking, really it does come down to the brutal logic of getting in behind the opposition, getting into goals, scoring scenarios, and scoring more goals. And that's, you know, like we said earlier, like, the more simple it sounds, the more, you know, it's the truest form of, this is my football philosophy.
Yep.
And I think that's where Bielsa sits on the attacking scope of getting between lines more. He has his own individual performance plans and individual performance indicators of how many times a certain player should get between lines, and as do Liverpool. So, again, another you know, Pep and Linders brought initiatives with him from Porto, which is an initiative is how many, you know, if you've received the ball between lines or you pass the ball in amongst lines, you get a point, an initiative, Pep calls it. So, you know, a certain position will have, a centre mid might be 40. So a good centre mid will get 40 initiatives a game. And if you go back to, and I think there's something called packing out there now, which is a German thing. And you go back to the Iceland-England game, the Euros, England had all the possession and it looked like England dominated. But actually, if you were just to count the number of times you get between lines and into dangerous areas, Iceland outscored that England team by quite a significant distance and deserved to win the game based on that. Mm-hmm. So possession is no longer the, and it shouldn't have ever been, but is no longer the indicator of whether you've dominated a game, but dominating the game is dominating between lines, dominating behind lines. And that's what a lot of great managers are doing nowadays, and a lot of great coaches and thinkers are looking at, is not just that, but like, how do we create more moments of dominating games like that? And that's Bielsa, that's Pep and Linders, and I'm sure that's Klopp, it's, you know, it's many people.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, for Bielsa, it's more like to encourage fluidity, to encourage freedom for players who quote unquote deserve that freedom, you know, when they are creative enough and their level of ability allows them to be free and play in a free role, then we see that fluidity from a Bielsa team sort of. So yeah, I guess, you know, we mentioned a few other people who sort of have similarities with Bielsa. So I guess throughout the years we've seen some managers being called the disciples of Bielsa, you know, back in the La Liga, some would say, you know, Jorge Sampaoli is now the manager of Sevilla. He's one of the disciples of Bielsa. And then maybe a bit closer to home for Liverpool fans, you know, managers of two Premier League clubs, Pochettino, and then to a certain extent, Pep Guardiola also being disciples of Marcelo Bielsa. So I guess with that said, you know, do you believe that these claims hold true? You know, do you think there are many managers out there who sort of take inspiration from Bielsa? And I guess additionally, do you think there are other teams or other managers who are currently trying to emulate his playing style?
I think that certainly in the Spanish community, in the South American, the Latin community, I'd find it hard to believe there weren't many who at some point have been influenced by one of his ideas without knowing it was his or not. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'll be honest with you, they're probably not Bielsa's ideas. Bielsa's taken them from a library of other ideas. He's just brought them together in a certain way. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more than we think, I think, who, you know, Pepe Linders will quote Bielsa, you know, as someone who's studied. Tim Lees, who used to work at Liverpool, is now in America, enjoys looking at Bielsa and taking ideas from him. That's at one level. And at the other level, you've got, you know, England women's manager will have studied him. In America, Anson Dorrance has looked at him as an idea. He's a successful women's coach. And then in the pro game in England, you've got Pochettino, and then there's, you know, I'm sure Van Gaal has equally looked at him as a set of ideas as well as himself, because Van Gaal was a great philosopher as well, although not well-liked and a bit more rigid with his ideas. Mm-hmm. Sampaoli, I mean, Chile at the last World Cup, I remember, I think it was 2010 against Switzerland, Bielsa subbed off a player and played with two wingers on the left and a fullback. So he played with three players down the left, and on the right-hand side, they left Sanchez on his own. At the last World Cup against Netherlands, Sampaoli did the same. He played, and unfortunately for Sampaoli, the second he did that, Netherlands changed what they were doing. But he played three players down the left and took off a midfielder, mm-hmm. and left a player on the right. So, you know, I think there are, you know, it depends. People who emulate everything he does, there's probably not many of them. You know, even Sampaoli will go and say he likes possession a bit more than Bielsa did. You know, he looks at Guardiola and takes ideas from him. Guardiola certainly has been inspired by his way of thinking more than anything else. There's probably not any other perfect replica of Bielsa, and if there was, then you'd have to question that as well and ask why they're being the perfect replica. But on a whole, there's a lot of people who have been inspired, whether that be 10% or 90% of their ideas have come from watching Bielsa's team play, watching him train, which is a totally separate thing. So Simeone has taken ideas from his training methodology, but not necessarily his playing style. You know, and there's so many managers out there, and some who we don't know about because they don't openly say, hey, I've taken inspiration from Bielsa and him doing this. And it might even be that you've been inspired by Pochettino, which inadvertently means you've been inspired by maybe Bielsa's ideas, because Pochettino played under Bielsa and saw the whole operation happen in front of his own eyes as he was a part of it. But he's certainly a good source of information and a good source of how to think about the game and how to learn. So I don't see why it's a bad thing that anyone would be inspired by Bielsa or anyone that would come across, Guardiola, Sampaoli, any of those.
Yeah, I'm sure many managers, you know, how their playing style and I guess their training philosophies and things like that. I'm sure at least part of, you know, their whole modus operandi is sort of drawn from many managers before them, you know. So even Arrigo Sacchi probably learned a few of the tricks of the trade from managers before him. Even Johan Cruyff, even some of the top managers out there, you know, they pick and choose the different things that they like from different managers and put them together, and that is sort of their recipe for success. So not too surprised about, you know, not having the perfect replica of a Bielsa team out there. But yeah, I think you made some really, really great points and mentioned a few really good teams and good managers at the same time. So I think now maybe briefly we could talk about Liverpool a little bit. So we mentioned that there may be similarities between a Bielsa team and a Jurgen Klopp team for Liverpool at the moment. Maybe you'd like to give your short opinion or insight on that. You know, do you think there are many similarities or not that many? What do you think?
I think there are. I mean, you could say any manager and I could probably draw out similarities, but with Klopp especially, and he's come in and taking his pure vision of football, and not just sold it to the players, but sold it to the fans and got the fans involved and created this one environment of everyone's involved. And, you know, I remember, and you probably heard it, there's a leaked tape of after Bilbao lost their second cup final. One of the players, unfortunately, or one of the staff members, and hopefully that person left, recorded Bielsa's post-match team talk. And in that team talk, he's saying that players are... they've lost touch with what it means to be from Bilbao and lost touch with the common man in the stands, and how, you know, he really emphasizes the lack of elite performance environment, which really comes down to everything. It comes down to your player-to-player relationships, the players-to-coach relationship, the coach-to-coach, the player-to-fan relationship, and the coach-to-fan relationship. He attacks the players for laughing the day after losing a game and having a good time. And I think what he's trying to do is allude to this idea that the environment is one of the most important things to get right. The morals and the principles you hold yourself accountable to, you know, and Klopp's brilliant at that. You know, Klopp is someone I've looked at and I've studied. Of course, I've studied his playing style and I've seen a bit of insight into his training methodology through friends who have video footage of him running sessions, but It's the way he's implemented his ideas and come in and change the environment, and the fact he's standing on the sidelines now waving his arms towards the fans and the fans know they're a part of it. You know, that's football for me, and that's where Klopp and Bielsa cross paths on that front more than anything else. but also, you know, we could look at a specific tactical point of playing forwards and moving or counter-pressing, you know, in that moment that Klopp says is the letter of the law, and that's what he abides by, and has really formed a culture around counter-pressing. Well, in the same way that Bielsa formed a culture around pressing and rotation on the ball, and, you know, it's about creating cultures of these ideas and making them so strong that they're non-negotiables. And I think that those similarities are huge between Klopp and Bielsa. But Klopp is... You know, if you pin me to the ground today and say, who's the manager who fascinates you most in the world right now, it's Klopp. And it's Klopp because of these reasons. And it's the same reasons I went and looked at Bielsa. You know, he takes a 4-3-3, which is a simple man's non-complex formation. Mm-hmm. he's not done anything too complicated. And if you watch his team play and study the movement of players, yeah, there's a few variabilities, but there's nothing groundbreaking in that. It's all simple football, but it's simple football played really well. You know, players that believe in the cultures that exist in the training ground and off the training ground because Klopp's brought them in. And I think that's where the similarities are, and that's where my interest in both of them lies, is in that, rather than, you know, in this moment we must have this type of formation.
Yeah, I guess I really love the how you mentioned about, you know, off the pitch things and on the pitch things. You know, there are things about Klopp and Bielsa's passion and the way they conduct themselves, the way they speak to players, speak to the press and things like that. It feels so much more different than, you know, the average manager out there. And I guess when it comes to tactics, you know, we can see some similarities there as well. I remember watching a Marseille game when Bielsa was coaching them, and I see some similarities with the Liverpool team. I know the front line being very, very fluid, very flexible. Last time, I believe at Marseille, Bielsa had someone like André Pierre Gignac sort of moving from the centre as a central striker to wide areas, and then we see someone like Dimitri Payet moving from the middle to wide areas. André Ayew maybe going from wide areas to the middle. It's very, very similar to the Liverpool team now. And obviously Firmino dropping back to become an attacking midfielder from being a striker. We see Coutinho cutting in from the left wing. We see Mane cutting infield in from the right wing and things like that. So yeah, from from that front, I can see a lot of similarities, and then the intensity of pressing from both teams, you know, I think that goes without saying, a lot of similar signs there as well. So yeah, Jack, I think it's pretty needless to say that Bielsa is a great manager, and he has many great philosophies as well, and the way he conducts himself. I believe Liverpool fans can find some similarities between him and someone like Jurgen Klopp. So I think yeah, before we close out this podcast, Jack, any final closing thoughts from you?
No, I've got a question for you, more or less, because you've watched Liverpool more than I have over the last year. Of course, I've watched, but like, do you ever foresee, and it's something we've been thinking a lot about a few lately, but do you ever foresee Klopp using a real nine? You know, I mean, Daniel Sturridge has been pushed aside and Firmino's coming, and I see the value in that, especially in the defensive side of the game. But can you see Klopp's Liverpool ever signing a true nine and playing a true nine up front?
Yeah, I think that's the question that has been looming around a lot of, you know, the Liverpool fan base and things like that. We've seen a lot of success with someone like Firmino, but we are yet to see if, you know, a proper nine can work in the long run for a Jurgen Klopp team at Liverpool. But I think it comes down to the depth of players that he has. You know, I think if he can sign flexible but you know, effective players who can play in the line just before the striker, you know, maybe the left attacking midfielder, the central and the right wing, you know, if they can be effective in terms of scoring goals, then maybe we may see a proper nine up top to support the play, you know, maybe someone who can hold up, play really well, but still score goals whenever they are inside the box. Maybe Daniel Sturridge is not that player yet, or maybe he's just not that type of player. Maybe Sturridge is someone who excels in, you know, making those runs in behind the lines and trying to score goals from there, but not really that, you know, when you think of someone like Robert Lewandowski, you think of him as that target man who can hold up the ball, make those passes and score goals. Maybe Daniel Sturridge is not that yet. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but that's my take on it.
Well, no, I think it does. I think Lewandowski was who I had in mind, but I mean, we've just signed a true nine at Fury now, is a great player. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting, you know, and we've got similar principles, right? We want to counter press and press up the field, and we take a lot of inspiration for Klopp and Bielsa. So it's interesting looking at that, looking at using a true nine. And mm-hmm. I know Benteke didn't work out at Liverpool, and you know, but Lewandowski did under Klopp. So it's certainly achievable. It's just that what kind of profile that looks like and what that looks like. And Firmino's great. Like, I love watching Liverpool's front three right now. Mm-hmm. So I'd actually be disappointed if he bought in Lewandowski or someone. I mean, not Lewandowski, but that type of profile, because it's almost goes against what his current success is.
Yeah, for sure.
No, it's an interesting area. It's certainly the most interesting area at the minute that we're looking at mm-hmm. with Klopp's side.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest worries for Liverpool fans at the moment is if, say, you know, Roberto Firmino gets maybe suspended, or if he gets injured, then what is the Liverpool side going to look like for the long term? You know, is Sturridge going to be able to keep up as the true number nine? Well, maybe Origi, is Origi maybe that type of player that Klopp likes, you know? Mm-hmm. I think there are so many questions that are looming around. Then, yeah, I think that's a great question from yourself. So yeah, I guess apart from that, any final thoughts from yourself yet?
No, just, you know, for me, it's like Liverpool right now are the one side everyone, well, not everyone, but certainly the football thinkers and the neutrals are watching and want to take a great deal of information out of because of what Klopp's achieving. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's a good time to be a Liverpool fan, but it's been a good time to be a Liverpool fan for a long while now in terms of thinking about the game. As much as people look back at Rodgers now and don't appreciate what he did, mm-hmm. I think Rodgers is still, you know, he was still a progression upon Roy Hodgson. You know, and Rodgers was someone who, for many people, ignited a passion of wanting to learn and look at the game a certain way. Maybe they've gone away and made different conclusions now, but, you know, I appreciate a lot what Rodgers did, and now, you know, we're watching Klopp, and it's it couldn't be better. Like, I can't think of many better managers out there that I'd want at Liverpool and doing things at Liverpool. So it's a good time to be a Liverpool fan.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think a lot of Liverpool fans have the same thought of, you know, this Liverpool team, I guess from the outlook of it, they shouldn't work, you know, in terms of functionality, they shouldn't be working as effectively as they do, but they just do, you know, somehow, you know, it may seem cliche, but the sum of its parts are much greater than the individual components that make it. So, you know, I believe if that's it, we have come to the end of this very interesting podcast. If I could say so myself, you know, Jet, you've been very, very excellent and a really great guest as expected. Thank you so much for coming on to share your insights, share your knowledge and thoughts about Marcelo Bielsa and giving your own personal thoughts here and there about Liverpool and things like that. So, as a return, maybe you'd like to let listeners know where and how to find you, how to get a copy of your newly released book about Marcelo Bielsa himself, and I guess anything else you'd like to plug?
I'm probably most accessible on Twitter, and my Twitter handle is @TPIMBW, which is unfortunately something I chose before I really started using Twitter, but it's an acronym for a poem, The Path is Made by Walking, mm-hmm. By Antonio Machado. But so that's Twitter, and the new book, which is probably going to be on sale to the 10th of December, and then I need to restock it because we're running out of books. So in January, and it's available from rocketbirdlondon.com. January, the new year, there'll certainly be books available. And those who are listening in the States and North America and outside of Europe, it's certainly going to be a lot cheaper in the future to get the book posted, because I'm getting it created abroad, and there'll be a stock in North America and a stock in Australia, so it should be a lot cheaper for everyone from now on.
Yeah, that's great. You know, do check out that book. I believe many people have given you great feedback on it. I've seen it all around Twitter. So a huge congratulations on the release of that book. And I hope many, many more copies get shipped out, and hopefully stocks don't last.
Yeah.
So that's great. You know, listeners, do check those out. You know, once again, to find Jet on Twitter, if you can't remember the Twitter handle, I believe Entry Index, whenever they tweet out this podcast, you can find Jet's Twitter handle there. So do give him a follow. So Jet, thank you so much once again for coming on. You've been a great guest as always. I'd love to have you on again in the future. Consider this an open invitation to yourself.
Yeah, thank you very much, Leroy, and I'll certainly be back at some point when we can make time work. And I apologise again for waiting over 3 months to finally make this happen, but thank you very much.
Nah, no worries at all. Really happy to have you on once again. Honoured to have you on. So, and you know, thank you, listeners, for listening to this special episode of the Entry Index Talking Tactics podcast. I've been your host, Leroy Ma, and we'll see you next time. Network.